welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Tonight, our conversation includes you, as it does every week. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, that's the number. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, 877-941-3689. 4 years ago, a book of essays caused quite a stir. The Value of Hawaii was filled with perspectives about Hawaii's cultural, economic, and political journey that had brought the state to where it was. The book went on to be taught in university classrooms and to create dialogue around the state, including over several weeks of statewide conversation on Town Square. Now The Value of Hawaii 2 is out, and there have been some changes, notably two new editors and a host of essayists, all under 40, sharing their future visions for a state they'll most likely inhabit, as their ideas may be integrated into a changing way of life in the islands. The essays are topically grouped, very personal, and often short. Tonight on Town Square, we'll start our series with an overview of The Value of Hawaii 2. We'll talk with editors Aiko Yamashiro and Noelani Goodyear Kaopua. And if you've read The Value of Hawaii 2, we want to hear from you. Again, our number is 941-3689 if you're on Oahu, or 877-941-3689. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's such an honor to be here. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad.
Now that you've gotten that over with, looking at this book, I mean, one of the first things that you notice when you've just flipped to any of the essays is how deeply personal, how evocative, and how incredibly potent they are. In addition to being very short, accessible, and readable, were those your criteria going into it, or did that sort of just happen? Aiko? Noelani? You're looking at each other, one of you.
Well, the first thing that comes into my mind is I don't have a favorite essay in the book, but I have a favorite first line, and it's the line that starts John Prime's essay, and the line is, "Kids can smell bullshit." And it's so true, first of all. And that essay is about urban youth and art and his work with 808 Urban to create these art programs for kids to be connected with community, to tell stories about their community visually on walls, these beautiful murals they create. And that feeling of his essay is, I think, really real, really vulnerable, very honest. And all of those things are spurred from how much he cares about what he does. And I think this is true of all of the writers in here. And I know one of the visions I had for this book was for it to be kind of raw and honest in that way, because that's how you hit people. That's how you impact people, by being okay with starting an essay saying kids can smell bullshit.
And getting them right in the gut.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that was really wonderful about the first volume was that it really gave people an overview of where we are as a community.
How we got here.
How we got here, and some ideas for how we can move forward. And what we wanted to continue on with that book is to get people at a personal level to think, well, how can I, as an individual or as part of my family or neighborhood, contribute to visions that I hold important for Hawaii. So it was really thinking about how could we tap into other people's stories of how did they get involved in leading something like 808 Urban or restoring fish ponds or becoming an organic farmer or pursuing ways to rethink waste or rethink urban development, you know. How did various individuals pursue whatever their passion and gifts were, and then take that next step into really becoming active?
So if this idea of being very raw and something that really, truly hits you right in your viscera became a guiding principle for you, how did you guys get to that point of making that a guiding principle? Because, you know, that was long before John Prime wrote those lines that you came together and began to think about this book in light of what had already come with the first volume. What was your first meeting like when you first sat down, the two of you, and decided to do this book? Do you remember your first conversation? Is that long ago?
Well, this is maybe a tangent, but that threading through this book, this emotion, this poetry, because there are actual poems in here, these personal stories, those were all very conscious decisions, part of our vision for what we wanted. And I think to answer that question, it's interesting to think about what is the history of activism here in Hawaii, and who are our heroes? You know, who are the activists, and what kinds of movements have it lived on and inspired us today? One story that I think of is when George Helm, as a young early 20-something, was trying to gain community support for saving Koho'olawe and for reclaiming that island. He would go around and play music, right? And all the old tutu would come and listen, and they would want to help because of that kind of emotional, spiritual act on that level. So I think, for me anyway, when we got together for our first meeting with all these other really cool people doing awesome community things, I think all of us knew that to get people to do things and to inspire other people, you need to have those sort of elements in there. That's what's going to be a powerful thing.
Well, that was when you came together as the group, the small hui that were going to help, or who were going to help create the book and figure out who should be doing what. But when you first got this project sort of handed off to you, and the two of you first sat down and looked at each other, was there a sense that there was already a flow to this book, or that you already knew how you wanted to see it happen, even if you hadn't really discussed it? Because obviously you're just sitting down for the first time.
Yeah, we were really lucky because both of the editors of the first volume were mentors to each of us. And so they trusted us and said, take this project and run with it. And so when we sat down, Aiko and I, to talk about how we wanted it to be similar and how we wanted it to be different, we talked about what we loved about the first volume. We talked about what were some of the things that couldn't fit within the limits of a single book that we wanted to add and bring to the table in terms of this second volume. And then after those conversations, then we involved a little bit wider group to brainstorm and think about who might be good contributors.
If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about The Value of Hawaii 2. It's the companion volume to The Value of Hawaii that came out 4 years ago. A very different book, a very deeply personal book, lots of essays in it from people who are in a very different age group and who have different ideas and visions for how the state should go forward. If you've read the book, or if you have questions about it, we want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you are on the Neighbor Islands or listening to the live stream tonight, my guests are Aiko Yamashiro, and I should say Aiko Yamashiro, get that right, and Nolani Goodyear Kaupua. They are the editors of The Value of Hawaii 2, and they had the rather daunting task of taking this off and creating it after the great success of The Value of Hawaii. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. How did you begin to formulate the list of people? There are so many people that you could have had who also have wonderful voices, but the book had to be limited to what it was, and there were so many areas that weren't part of the first book. I mean, perhaps most notably the whole issue of spirituality that was never touched in that mm-hmm. first book. How did you begin to talk about what you wanted to see this book be?
I think we talked about some of those issues. What were some of the themes that we wanted to continue on and carry on in this book? And what were some of the things that we wanted to make sure got added that we see as really integral and crucial to the things that people value in Hawaii. One of the things, for example, that we talked about is that we thought there was great representation among the authors in the first volume from the Hawaiian community and Caucasian community in the islands, but there were ethnic groups that were not represented at all, really, in the first volume. And we wanted to make sure there was a more representative sort of diversity of ethnic backgrounds for people who were writing and contributing to the book. That was one thing.
Well, specifically who? I mean, for those people who have read the first volume, who may or may not remember what was in the book fully, what did you want to see specifically in this book that was absent in the first volume?
Well, one of the things that we wanted to try to do was really resituate Hawaii in the context of Oceania or the Pacific, and not sort of see ourselves as the 50th state backwater in relation to the U.S., but, you know, really situated in this richly diverse cultural space of Oceania. And so we really wanted to make sure that there were Pacific Islander voices included in the book as well. And so in the book, we have poets and essayists who are, from Chuuk, from the Marshall Islands, Tokelauan, you know, those kinds of groups that are here in the islands and are important parts of our community, but that you don't often hear from.
Or if you do talk about them, in many ways, we hear that they'll be marginalized.
Yeah, exactly.
For a lot of people who are reading the book, that sense of Oceania isn't really part of their experience. I mean, they do feel, here we are in Hawaii and we have to make a living and we have to do all these things that we need to do. Was that a really sort of constant poke at everyone to say, hey, remember that you're in a larger, broader context in the world, and this is not just a matter of you having to have your little existence here in Hawaii, whatever it is you may be doing and feel is terribly important, but that there's a much broader context that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I get to teach undergrads at University of Hawaii Manoa, and we talk about Pacific literature and literature of Hawaii. And, if they've grown up here, and me too, growing up here, you can name the 50 states and the capitals and point out where they are on the map, but you don't know anything about other islands in the Pacific, you know, our cousins, who have cultures very similar to the Hawaiian culture and who have stories and kinds of wealth and knowledge that is really important for us to think about as islanders. But instead, we're always looking towards the continent and trying to kind of mimic these models that don't make any sense here. So, yeah, like Noe was saying, one of the really conscious things we were trying to do was to explore that idea. We are islanders. We are part of Oceania, which doesn't mean we're these insignificant, tiny dots, but that we are stewards of the ocean, which is the most powerful force.
You put a lot of emphasis on the ocean, obviously, than perhaps just the land. We tend to think more of the land than the ocean.
Yeah, it was very that was another purposeful thing that we tried to include, you know, that there were essays that we wanted to invite that specifically engaged ocean resources. So there's essay about fish pond restoration, essay about voyaging, which is really great timing now as the worldwide voyage of the Hokulea and Hikianalii are happening. So we wanted to, you know, remind ourselves and our communities about that. That's one of the things that makes us special and valuable is this vast and powerful and rich ocean that we live within.
Sort of juxtaposed with that idea, though, is the reality that we have so many people moving to Hawaii and bringing with them whatever culture they come from. And if you want to call it the culture of the continent or wherever they may have been traveling, that impact on how they see what is going on in Hawaii, or at least that lens through which they're looking, is a very different one from what a lot of these essays would like to show us. How do you see those two things living in concert? Is that possible?
Yeah, I think that was another thing that we purposely tried to include and address within the book is how can people who are bringing different kinds of cultural backgrounds see this place as one where they honor and respect the native culture, as well as, you know, appreciate and add to the diversity that we have here. So there's a really beautiful story about a Tokelauan language school, and the author Betty Ickes talks about how Hawaii really was a sort of place for her and her community, that it actually nurtured and gave them a space to continue practicing, you know, their culture. And she and other essayists within the book kind of struggle with this question, because I think it's one that you have to keep asking about how do you maintain those cultural traditions while also honoring the host culture that you're entering into. And I think each of the essayists has sort of different ways of approaching and negotiating those questions in their own lives, depending on the context.
The inverse of that also seems to be a question that some are asking. What happens with sort of Hawaii expats? I'm thinking about the essay in there from Ryan Oishi, and mm-hmm. when he goes to the mainland for a series of weddings and friends who were all, I think, in his punahou class, and then they're all talking about how Hawaii is moving and changing and certain things that they think, oh, it's not going to happen, not going to change. And, you know, his dismay at mm-hmm. all of that. And yet that little, you know, vignette, many people could replicate that when we have family members who can no longer have a lifestyle here in Hawaii that they want and they go someplace else. So a lot of, you know, parents very upset that their children go off to the continent, to the mainland, whatever you want to call it, that it's not here. And that changes them irrevocably.
Yeah, Ryan is a good friend, and he went to Punahou, graduated from Punahou, and teaches at Kamehameha now as a literature teacher. And part of what he was writing about in his essay on private education was about that kind of transformative experience himself growing up as this local Asian and with a certain idea of success. And then encountering these very different worldviews as he started to learn about the literature that actually came from this place and Hawaiian literature in particular. One of the things I love about his essays is when he's talking about what you were saying, you know, this kind of paucity of imagination or this inability to imagine certain things for our future, for our shared future. What he comes to is this idea that if we have more stories, if we have more foundational stories, different kinds of foundational stories that we know, then our imagination will be different. We'll be freer. We'll not be trapped in these same ideas of what is wealth, what is success. He, in particular, is talking about teaching different kinds of mo'olelo or Hawaiian stories of being here. And as an English person myself, as somebody who studies literature, I love that idea that the more stories we have, the more kind of vision for a future, the more options we have. A good friend put it, the more stories we tell, the more stories our daughters will have.
Daughters.
Yeah.
Well, and that brings up sort of another point that threads through this, is that there definitely is, at least in part of the book, a very feminist theme, or at least a new concept of what feminism should be, and not in the sense of what we saw happening in the 70s. That was also a very conscious choice on your part to have us look at ourselves. I mean, we've seen beauty campaigns. You know, the Dove beauty campaign came out with all kinds of visions of beauty, and you saw women of color. We see far more women who are older, younger, of color, not in a traditional, you know, what might have been the Barbie doll mentality of the 50s or 60s or 70s, looking very different now. And for a lot of people, I think, well, that's changed. But your point in the book, at least some of the essays, and I'm thinking of the one that Jamaica Osorio wrote about, is we're not there yet, but we could be there soon.
Yeah, I don't think we approached it with a sort of intentionally or consciously thinking that this is, I mean, we did want an essay that would address gender for sure in the book. I think where maybe this, the style of the book has affinities with feminism is that whole idea of the personal is political, that we really wanted people to be able to read personal narratives and stories about how individuals and families and communities got involved, and to see that that's just as political as a sort of universal list approach to describing what the situation is.
But there are a lot of grandmothers that appear in
there
this
are,
book.
Yes,
a lot
there
of grandmothers and a lot of stories. Right now, we're going to see what story our caller has on the line. If you'd like to join us, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you're calling us from the Neighbor Islands, we're talking about The Value of Hawaii 2. Just came out at the end of last month, and it may be on your bookshelf. If it is, if you've had a look at it or you have some questions about it and you read the first volume, Call us 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Walter, calling us from Nanakuli. Aloha. Thank you for taking my call. And thank you for your patience.
Yes, hi. The question I'm about to ask is the same question I asked my Hawaiiana teacher at UH West Oahu. And that question is going to be preceded by a quick follow-up. And that is, why do Hawaiians, Native Hawaiians, feel they hold a special connection to the land of Hawaii? Unlike anyone else. Could you answer that, please?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to speak for all people, Native Hawaiians or non-Native Hawaiians, but one of the things that some of the essayists emphasize in the book, and there are both Hawaiians and non-Hawaiians who talk about what it means to feel a connection, is a genealogical, a long time over generations and generations, hundreds of generations, connection, and that connection is often lived and renewed through the telling of stories and our genealogies, and then of course the material practices of being on the land and subsisting and surviving from the resources that it provides.
What Walter, I think,
teacher told me it sprung out that they actually believed Hawaiian sprung out from the land. From that, I forgot the title of the story, but Hawaiians were planted into the ground and sprung out. And that's why taro is heavily guarded as sacred. Is that correct?
There is, yes, there's a story, one of the creation stories that has to do with the birth of Kalo that we call Haloa Nakalau Kapalili, who's the elder sibling of all Kanaka, of Hawaiian people. And that's certainly a really important foundational story for us.
Walter?
Walter, that's not true and we're all migrants to this land, does anyone hold any more of a connection to this land or property to it?
One of the things that we try to engage the essayists in the book is really to think about how each of us, from our different positions and relationships to the land and to other communities that live here, have responsibilities to one another. So we weren't really trying to have a sort of comparison, who's more connected, who's more responsible, but really from our different positions and our different histories, recognizing and celebrating those, and then thinking about how across different positions we can be responsible to one another.
Because clearly, by the essays in the book, the connections that people feel are very real and very deep. And you don't have everyone writing this who is Native Hawaiian. I mean, you really took such a broad brush in looking at who you wanted to paint what picture that I think, if you have a look at the book, Walter, some of that may get answered for you. But in just reading it myself, that was one of the things I noticed about it, that you had a lot of people who didn't matter whether they were Native Hawaiian or not, the sense of real deep rootedness that they felt in Hawaii was palpable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to add to that, I think that is an issue that we wanted to touch because it means so much to people. So there are all kinds of people who contributed to this book, and all of them, without question, call Hawaii home and are thinking really hard about what does it mean to love this place that we share as a home. And I think, when I think about the news and how the news kind of talks about all of us who live here, and they kind of segregate us into these different communities. And I'm not Hawaiian. My ancestors came from Okinawa and Japan, through the plantations, and I grew up local. In the news, again, you hear about the Native Hawaiians doing this or the Native Hawaiians doing that, and this kind of separation. And I'm not saying that we're not different, because I think we are. But I also think there's so many stories of us being together and us sharing with each other, and we love each other, we marry each other, we're deep friends, and all of our stories are woven together in this very unique way. So, and we support each other in that, like we show up for each other in our different community struggles. So I think part of what we were trying to do with that book is tell that very real history that often gets simplified into breaking us up into these different groups.
You're just listening to Aiko Yamashiro. She's one of the editors of The Value of Hawaii, too. That's what we're talking about tonight on Town Square. Different visions for Hawaii's future, largely coming from people who are under the age of 40, who have a very different perspective in some cases than some of those that we saw in the very first volume of The Value of Hawaii. If you read the first book and have questions about the second, tonight's the time to ask. If you've read the book already, we want to hear from you and what you think of these very deeply personal stories that show much more about Hawaii than just facts and figures, but really personal experiences that are deep and potent and quite revealing. 941-3689, 877-941-3689. It's tough to read the book and not feel touched by it in some way. I mean, it's just leaking emotion. Some would say that might be a criticism of the book. Noe?
Possibly. I mean, what we've heard so far is that that it's been really inspiring for people to read through the personal stories. And we really tried to have essayists give a balance between that kind of emotion and personal narrative with their real expertise. I mean, we weren't just kind of asking people who were good storytellers. We really were asking people who were to contribute to the book who have a lot of experience and commitment and work behind them in the fields that they comment on. But definitely one thing that I think is a little bit different about this volume than the second was that the first had very clear sort of boundaries, like health. Someone wrote about health. Someone wrote about education. Someone wrote about agriculture. And one of the things that we thought about was, well, in order to really create the kind of positive futures that we want, we need to see how to cross those silos, that, you know, there are really exciting and important things happening that bridge education and agriculture, or that bridge the arts and community building and health.
Sort of like life integrating, you know, across the board, where you have a lot of collaboration, but also the fact that none of this exists in a silo. And that was a way of being able to divine the first book. But this one, there's so much cross-pollination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that was very purposeful because, you know, I think both of us think that in order to think outside of the box of the various kinds of problems that we face as islanders here in Hawaii, that we need to think across and outside of the boundaries of, you know, the typical sort of thinking about what it means to provide health care, for example.
And integrated public policy.
Yeah.
And also, in thinking about this book, you know, not as a better version of the first one, but as a book that could work together with the first one, we're really grateful to the editors. And that first book just had so many kind of useful, well-researched essays that kind of work to give you an overview of a particular topic. And this book, through its emphasis on information but also personal storytelling, it serves, I think, more as a welcoming or as a source, a seed of inspiration for other people to think, oh, that's really cool, or oh, I connect with this and I would want to get involved with this issue or that issue, or we wanted people to be excited. And I think both of us teach, so we know that those kinds of stories resonate particularly with young people.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories, because although you have people who have great expertise in certain areas, not everyone who has written an essay in here was perhaps an essayist before or really had great experience or comfort with their own voices. How did you negotiate that as you were trying to create the pieces for this?
Yeah, we were lucky enough to have a sort of production schedule that allowed us as editors to get to collaborate with these authors with these people working in different community efforts who we admire so much, who don't always have the time or even the comfort to sit down and kind of write something. Some of them definitely are writers, but many of them are not. And so, yeah, our process was very evolved, very emotional, involved and emotional, I think. Some of these essays, they took hours and hours at a bar together, or like crying or kind of sharing stories first before they could be written. Some of them were recorded on cell phones and kind of transcribed later. And what a beautiful thing as an editor to be able to hear these stories and have some part in telling them.
But the way in which you are editing seems vastly different from what we know of editing. Did you find yourself questioning your place as an editor and how you would be able to work with this person versus that person?
I think some of it was very traditional sort of editing, particularly in the instances where there were people who felt very comfortable writing essays and having their voices published. And then another sort of role that we played, I think, is the one that oral historians kind of play at times, where you're, you know, engaging people in conversations and then helping to craft those conversations into written material. And for me, I think that was really important in certain cases where the place that the conversation took place was, you know, where it was located, shaped what kinds of stories were shared in ways that if someone had been sitting at a laptop in their office or in their home, the same kind of stories may not have come through. So, for example, the essay by Bonnie Kahapea Tanner that talks about navigation and voyaging, you know, we had that conversation at the ocean, literally looking out at Point Panics.
Read a little bit of it, if you would.
Sure, let me try to get there. I mean, one of the things that I really like about that essay, and this kind of goes back a little bit to what I was saying in response to the caller earlier, was that, you know, it's really about us confronting what are the responsibilities that we have to one another. So in that essay, she talks about how she was trained as a navigator by many people, but most central among them that she talks about is Papamaupialug, who's from Satawal, Micronesian background, and basically talks about, you know, how because of this gift and the sacrifices that he and his family made in order for him to be here in Hawaii to help to catalyze the revitalization of voyaging here in the islands, what is the long-term responsibility then that we have to reciprocate to Micronesian immigrants who are now coming to the islands?
And that's usually not a subject that a lot of people want to talk about.
Yeah, and it's, I think what she says, you know, she actually quotes him at the end. And she talks about how he says, you know, we need to think about how we are one people. So the quote that she has from him is talking about the way that he would use real simple kinds of objects, sticks and coral rocks, in order to create a star compass to teach these really complex kinds of ideas about voyaging. So he says, I put the stick between Micronesia and Polynesia. Now you walk on the stick like a bridge. I like we make one family. And then she says, Pius Maupialug was more than a navigator. He was a philosopher and a prophet. His teachings are timeless and timely. In today's world, what is old is new again. We are people of the Pacific, Moana Nui Akea, connected infinitely by the waters that touch each of our shores and flow through our veins. And so I think what we were really trying to do in this book that, you know, this sort of captures is to think about those connections, how we can build connections, that really one of the most valuable things about Hawaii is the connections that we make with each other, the connections that we make across difference.
Especially in a world that wants to divide us and it becomes increasingly more divisive and fragmented. We've got a caller on the line, Kanoa, calling us from Kalihi. Aloha. Thank you for your patience.
Aloha. I was wondering, is anyone on the panel Hawaiian?
Yes. My name is Noelani Goodyear Ka'opua. I'm Kanaka.
Aloha.
Aloha.
I was wondering, as a Hawaiian, what would you like to see for the future of Hawaii, political-wise? Would you like to see state within a state? Or would you like to see federal recognition? What would you like to see?
That is a great question, given the current political climate and the times that we're going through with the Department of Interior here. I think that and I'm just speaking for myself personally, I'm not speaking on behalf of the book, that what our history and our kupuna tells us is that independence was what they fought for, what they created for us. There's a great speech from 1897 by a man named James Kaulia, who talks about how the Poe Aloha Aina have to keep continuing to fight for that until the very last Aloha Aina. And my belief is that we haven't reached the very last Aloha Aina yet.
On what would that mean for the state of Hawaii right now? What would you like? How would that play out?
So what I'm saying is that, you know, they built an independent country, and that I eventually, whether it's in my lifetime or my children's or grandchildren's lifetime, I'd like to see us get back to that.
So would that have like the U.S. outside, get out of Hawaii, or just have recognition within Hawaii, the Hawaiians?
Again, this is just speaking personally, not behalf of the book,
right.
That I've always supported, moving toward meaningful independence for Hawaii, political, economic, all of those different aspects.
And that would mean everyone else out who wasn't Hawaiian?
No. The Kingdom of Hawaii was a multi-ethnic country. It was actually one of the most progressive at the time in terms of, for example, you know, welcoming African Americans who would have been enslaved in the South in the U.S. It was a very inclusive country.
Okay. I just want your opinion, because everyone has their voice. I just wanted to know what yours was.
Yeah, mahalo for asking the question.
Hey, mahalo.
Thanks very much for the call. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. For most of the show, we were talking about the value of Hawaii, too, until we got caught up in some current events, and which are current, past, and going into the future, as does this book, looking at visions for Hawaii. What's your vision for Hawaii? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you've read The Value of Hawaii, too, how does that sync with what you've read? Deeply personal, really some just amazing. Some of them are only a couple pages long, but the points and the emotions that just spill off the page are really incredible. One of the things that you notice. And in some cases, the book asks you to turn it around as you are turning around your thinking. Did you make that conscious choice, too, to say, okay, however you draw your essay, write your essay, want to see it printed, that's going to be the way it'll be in the book? Because most essays don't look like this.
Yeah, Beth Ann is talking about a particular essay by Jamaica Osorio, who if you know her, you would know that she'd be pleased that you have to turn the book to the side to read her essay, which is printed differently than the rest.
But even the drawings that are in it and the fact that there is so much poetry, that some people would say, well, that's not an essay. This was all a very conscious choice on your part to let them be the way they needed to be and not necessarily try to put shape and form to something beyond what the author wanted to do?
Actually, I think it was more about us pushing people to go ahead and break these sort of boundaries that we grew up thinking, oh, you have to write like this. Just like we kind of grew up thinking we can only envision a certain kind of future for ourselves, we're breaking sort of genre rules here, putting some essays have poems woven into them. There are really beautiful pieces of art that maybe Noi can talk more about. But we wanted to really engage people in all of those ways of thinking and feeling and hopefully kind of spawn other kinds of multi-genre projects.
This book, if it's anything like the other one, will continue to have a life well beyond its publishing date. Is it already scheduled to walk into classrooms as did the other?
We're working on some kind of developing some curriculum, although I feel like it's getting harder and harder what DOE teachers have to do in their classrooms now, being a little bit different than what they had to do or what kinds of resources they had a few years ago. But one of the, kind of going to your question about different kinds of writing, one of the current projects we're working on is just thinking about how to create more spaces for people to come together and share stories and be creative. So, for example, we're having an event next week where people are going to be sharing poetry. Some of the poets are from the book and some of the people are just poets. Well, they might not think of themselves as poets. They work in these awesome, they work for demilitarization or for gender rights or for sovereignty, but they don't often write poetry. So we ask them to kind of engage in a creative way, to write in a different way, to share something, and then create a space for that kind of sharing to happen in a more public space.
It seems with this book, too, just in reading through the essays, that you are asking people not just to think differently about the future, but to think very differently about themselves and to go inward as much as to look out at the future of Hawaii. Was that part of what you asked the essayist to do, to somehow be able to call people to look more inwardly?
Well, we definitely asked the contributors to think about what was their path? How did they become active? What have been some of the experiences, whether in their childhood or education or community work in their lives, that really got them to take seriously what their responsibilities are here in this place? And like I said, to kind of draw on their passions and gifts. And I think that that's often definitely an internal sort of process of looking at, you know, what is my calling and what are the gifts that I have to share and how can I do that in a responsible way?
But you're a political science professor.
Yes.
I mean, in your, some would say, your professional life. And yet a lot of the things that are talked about in the book that would have certain public policy outgrowths seem like they would be a far piece from where we are right now. How do you make that bridge that moves into some of these visions, given the fact that we have the political structure that we have now?
That's a good question. I mean, I do think that in some ways, the audience that each of the two volumes was aiming at were a little bit different, that the first volume really was trying to speak directly to policymakers, to people that have decision-making power within existing institutions. And this volume was really trying to speak to the everyday person, the young person, to really say that you don't just have to wait for people in power, in positions of power, to make change, that there are acts that you can have in your everyday life that will make a difference. So, you know, one of the really cool stories that I like is a story that closes the book that comes from James Koshiba's essay, and he talks about being really inspired by this auntie Alice Greenwood, who's part of the Concerned Elders of Waianae, and that at one point in her life she was homeless and living on the beach, and that she got really concerned about how the kids who were also living in with houseless families were playing on this really dirty floor in the public restrooms. And that her first sort of foray into political action was to simply make a commitment to clean the bathrooms every day, and that people would tell her, why are you going to do this? Shouldn't you complain to someone else to do this? And what happened through her commitment was that other people started to say, oh, Auntie, you shouldn't do that by yourself. Oh, I'll help you. I'll take the next day. And then they started to have this sort of rotating shift of who would clean. And it was a moment of real community cohesion and people taking responsibility for the place where they were all living, and I think was empowering. And I think it's a really neat kind of instance of how some of those everyday kind of acts and commitments that people make can be a form of political action that may eventually, you know, lead to policy change or engagement of those individuals and communities in policy advocacy.
And we should mention that we'll talk to James Koshiba. He'll be here as part of another panel in a couple of weeks. But interesting with that, too, because we spoke with her while she was in that houseless state.
Oh.
And I was just bringing that up, made me think of the conversation we had with her quite a long time ago now. We're talking about the value of Hawaii, too. Some of the stories and the stories behind the stories in the essays. If you've read the book, if you've got a question about it, 941-3689 is our number if you're on Oahu, or from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. When you stop to think about the word value, what does that mean for you as you live here in Hawaii and maybe looking out at a future that includes you or perhaps doesn't include you, as many people have already gone to other places because they feel they can't make a life here? What do you think about when you hear the word value and then couple that with Hawaii? 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Value is one of those very potent words. It's really laden with so much that you bring to it. Did you find yourselves questioning at all the word value and whose value and what value and really what does value mean in the context of Hawaii?
Yes, definitely. That was another sort of guiding thing that we were talking about when we were putting this book together. And then we're thinking about value, but also the idea of vaivai, or which has all of these other kinds of connotations that are, is not just about money, but about vaivai, which was a word for wealth, or is a word for wealth in Hawaiian, also means fresh water. So it's so interesting, right, to think about that kind of shift. What does it mean to think about wealth in terms of fresh water, in terms of caring for fresh water, in terms of being connected to your natural resources so that you know where your fresh water is coming from, which I don't know, you know? So that's just a start. I don't know if you want to add to that, Noi.
Yeah, I think you captured it well. That was an one of the ways that we were trying to sort of make an intervention into the ways that value is typically understood was to think about that idea and image of vaivai, that what's valuable here.
It's not just what comes out of your
wallet.
Or,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think to connect back to that idea of the audience not necessarily being the legislature or policymakers, but the audience being sort of regular people or people doing grassroots work. Just thinking about who has power and who has value. And one of the things that we were trying to kind of push for in this book that's different from the first one is to create spaces for people to share stories about spirituality and how that engages with community work and with feeling empowered. And I think that kind of conversation is not always valued in education or in government, right, to talk about spirituality.
And we're not talking, excuse me, but we're not talking about religion, but we're talking about a sense of spirituality and a different driver for why we're here and what we're doing in this space.
Yeah, for example, Jeff Acido writes about migrating to Hawaii from the Philippines, and but what does Christianity and what does Catholicism, what does that kind of religion mean to his community, and how does it kind of uplift them in very unexpected ways? But also there are other essays that talk about different kinds of things besides that. So yeah, not just not religion or not one kind of religion, but this idea of spirituality that is often missing, I think, in quote-unquote expert conversations. For example, I was just looking at an article about the development of the telescope on Mauna Kea. And the article was in the Pacific Business News. And it spent a really, really long time kind of breaking down what the value in terms of money, in terms of how much this sort of development was going to give to the community. And hardly any time, it kind of dismissed sort of these other kinds of claims, these other ways of valuing. And so I think one thing that this book is trying to do is to have us think a little bit more outside of economics, have us kind of break open what we think of as economics. I think, for example, of this woman, Vandana Shiva, who reminds us, she does a lot of work for food sovereignty and seed sovereignty. She reminds us that the root word of economics comes from this idea of home. So when we start to think of, like, what do we need to have a safe home?
And she was here almost 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, all of this said, because there are some wonderful ideas in here and heartfelt, I mean, deep, deep-rooted emotion that, as we talk about, just comes out of every page, then you're going to get people who are going to say to you, but what about the reality of some of these visions? And what might be nice to have or what might make your soul feel good? How do you make that sync with a world which is monetarily dependent, where people can't live in Hawaii the way they would like to live because they can't have the kind of lifestyle or have the opportunities that other places offer? There are a lot of people who will be very critical of this and say that, you know, this is not necessarily addressing some real problems, but it's painting some wonderful visions, and that's just not going to be enough.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, that I would say that the book isn't chicken soup for the soul. It's not a feel-good book. I think it actually tackles a lot of difficult kinds of questions, and it's not meant to just be sort of a
you know, emotional, feel good kind of a book. But I think also that one of the things that several of the essays try to get to is that we do need to think radically differently if we're facing the kinds of issues related to climate change, the need to make a radical transformation in terms of our dependence for sources of energy, in terms of the amount of waste that we produce. It's just simply not sustainable, and we actually do really need significant change in some of those areas, in many of those areas. And so there's an essay by Aubrey Yee, who does work in futures and future studies. And I think what the perspective that she brings to the table is that the kinds of solutions that are going to take us out of these major, you know, ecological and economic crises that we face will seem out there. You know, they will really seem sort of far-fetched. But it's really important for us to cultivate that kind of creativity and innovation in thinking.
Let's go see what OJ, calling us from Maui, is thinking. Aloha, OJ. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello.
Hi there.
Can you hear me all right?
We can, yes.
Yes, good. I just wanted to make a comment to your guest there. I think what they're doing is a wonderful, outstanding job in presenting new ideas to society.
OJ, and we can barely hear you. Can you speak right into your handset?
Oh, gee, I'm sorry.
Talk right into the handset.
Yeah, I thought I was. Okay, anyway, I just wanted to comment that I think what they're doing is a wonderful thing. I haven't read the book yet, but I certainly will get it. And I think society needs to be opened up to some new ideas. And the comment, the question that you posed them a few minutes ago, that, oh, there's going to be some that's going to oppose it because they don't want to make a change. Well, that's always been through society, through time. And this is the time that these young people are beginning to present something that we need to look at and allow them to expand on it and allow it to manifest. Because everything starts with one step, one idea, and it sounds as though they're making a wonderful opportunity to us to embrace.
OJ, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
If you had one wish for this book, that might be different from a wish that you might have had for the previous volume, which granted, I mean, you didn't have any hand in, but in the way that it was successful, in the way that it was, in many cases, embraced by the community, what would your wish for Volume 2 to be?
Well, Aiko had a huge hand in Volume 1. One of the things that I learned from watching Volume 1, not just come out and reading it and teaching it myself, was that they really used it as a way to be a springboard for community conversations and bringing diverse ideas and people together. And so, you know, that's something that I really hope we can replicate in the second volume.
But is there something different, Aiko, that you see happening with this book that would only be possible with this book, since it is so different from Volume 1?
I mean, I hope that we're kind of building all on the same movement, I feel like, just to get more and more people feeling empowered to take action in different ways, to connect with their own ancestors and to kind of be able to imagine different kinds of futures that are hopeful and that are exciting. I think, I don't know if it's a different thing, but I mean, I think both books, actually, they're just really inviting people to engage with it, to make it live, to rewrite it, or to, you know, kind of riff off of it and write their own if they want, or to share their own, really as a leaping off point to grow this collective movement of being together, imagining, connecting, that idea of ancestral roots, oceanic visions, which is our subtitle.
Yeah, I guess I would add to that, you know, if I could have one wish as far as in an ideal world, that, you know, everyone who reads or is able to be touched by the conversations that come out of the book could take away at least one concrete thing that they can do and commit to in their lives to contribute toward a more, to what they see as a positive vision for Hawaii.
And that wasn't something that you saw as part of the first book?
I think it was. I mean, I also teach at the university, and I think there were several essays that offered really wonderful ideas for policy change, like we talked about. But for an undergraduate, you know, for someone who's 20, who's reading these things, it's difficult for them to connect their life path, the responsibilities that they have to do, and how that change can happen. So if people could be able to make those connections, what are some of those everyday things that they can do that also connect to larger policy change? That's something that I would love to see.
Well, life at 20 looks very different than life at 40. And that's pretty much where a lot of you are right now, just under 40 and looking at the world in which you're going to be here for hopefully a very long time. Are some of those changes, you know, built in, or are some of these things more a function of age in the way someone is regarding the world? Do they have longevity?
I think, you know, I reread the whole book today, and I was kind of crying and shaking and just, you know, proud of everyone in it. And one thing that I kept hearing in essay after essay for these, you know, quote-unquote young people is this idea of going back to learning about our ancestors, learning about our past, being connected to that, and that is where the creativity and inspiration comes from. Hunter Heivillen, for example, who writes about waste in Hawaii and his own kind of personal journey to try to live a lifestyle where he produces no waste at all, he kind of talks in a very scientific way, but also he talks about how this kind of future radical vision of really thinking about waste and going back to being able to produce your own food and being empowered in those ways will take us closer to our past and to our future. And I think so many of the essays touch on that.
But the idea, for example, of making our own food and doing some of these things that you might be able to do in small ways, you've got a lanai, maybe you can grow some tomatoes or doing something that, and that goes back to your point, Noe, of doing something, of being able to feel like you have some sort of hand in some sort of future and not mm-hmm. passively sitting there and just, you know, letting it happen to you.
Yeah, I think that's a really important theme that actually comes up quite a bit in several of the essays, is particularly food and the way that we really need to transform our food systems, that it's not sustainable for us to be importing 90% or so of our food, and that for the generations who are coming up right now, that the urgency of that problem, I think, is something that people are, in my perception, more aware of now than they were 20, 30 years ago. And that there's a lot of exciting things, maybe on small community levels, but that are happening in various places.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming in tonight and talking about the book. Got to tell you, I enjoyed it and wish you a lot of success with it.
Thank you so much.
And we'll talk more about it over the next couple of weeks, very specific parts of the book with different panelists, and we hope you'll plan to join us too. But thanks very much to Aiko Yamashiro and Noelani Goodyear Kaupua, both editors of The Value of Hawaii 2. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you tomorrow morning right here for the conversation at 8 o'clock. Meanwhile, have yourselves a good evening. Aloha.